Hi, everybody, and welcome to Two Out the First for today, November the 21st, 2022. I am Ryan Ballingy. Great to have you here with us. We are presented by our friends at French Lick Resort in French Lick, Indiana. We have two stories for you, as the name of the show implies. We have not talked about one story that we'll get to at the, as kind of the back end of this, and then we'll start with the weekend that was in golf and some stories that kind of came out of that, namely the LPGA's CME Group Tour Championship, and we'll kind of bring it all together for you as we have a great, hope you have a great Thanksgiving week. Do a couple shows this week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Obviously, we're not going to do one Thursday. Maybe a Black Friday show. We'll see, depending on how it all works out. But at least three shows this week for you on the YouTube channel, on our website, golfnewsnet.com, and also on your favorite podcasting service and Golf News Net Radio. So, let's start with the LPGA because we had a great finish to the CME Group Tour Championship over the weekend in Naples, Florida, Tiburon Golf Club, which hosted the tournament once again. It's a winner-take-all event, so unlike the other points races that are on the major tours between the PGA Tour and the DP World Tour, it's a little bit different because you have a reset on the FedEx Cup and the Tour Championship, and you have starting strokes and a handicap on the DP World Tour. The final event is more points, and there's a tournament with a big purse, and we'll talk about that a little bit, but also a bonus pool based on all the points. So there's two kind of separate pools of money to pull from, and there's a reason for that. We'll get to that. But the CME Group Tour Championship is a pure sprint to $2 million. It's the biggest prize, first place prize, ever awarded in the history of women's golf. So we had a $10 million tournament this year for the U.S. Women's Open presented by ProMedica. First time a purse on the LPGA has reached that amount of money, and $1.8 million went to the winner because 18% is paid to the winner of USGA events at that level. And that on the LPGA typically is 15%. So it's a little bit more for the USGA. So Terry Duffy, who is the CEO of CME Group, who kind of concocted this whole concept and then sold the LPGA on it probably pretty easily several years ago, he said he wanted to have the biggest first place prize in women's golf and in women's golf history. We're going to jack up the purse. We're going to make it $7 million. Was $5.5 million. We're going to give $2 million to the winner, $550,000 to second, and that's the way we're going to be the biggest tournament at women's golf because we're going to have the biggest payday. 60 players in the field. Now, to qualify, you had to be the top 60 in points somehow getting into the final day or the final week of the season after the Pelican Women's Championship. And so you had a couple players who were qualifying. I think three players qualified, could not play. Jessica Korda, Lynn Grant, because she's unvaccinated and couldn't get into the United States, and Imbi Park, who I kind of have a feeling might be walking away from the game pretty soon. But nevertheless, you still had a really strong field, and you had a really interesting tournament. Up through 36 holes, it was Lydia Coes. I mean, she was up by five strokes on the field. It looked like there was nobody that was going to stop her. Then Saturday happened. She stalled out. Wind came. It got difficult. Leona Maguire found a way to play a great round of golf, got herself right in there into the final group along with Jung-Un Lee 6. And then, what, five, six holes into the final round, they were a combined, you know, they were tied five clear of the field. It was a match play situation. In the end, though, there were some comebacks. Lee 6 played well. Georgia Hall played well. Anna Nordqvist and Hall both shot 67s. They moved up into third and T4, respectively. And Maguire made a thing of it. She got to 15 under after birdieing the 17th hole. And then Lydia Ko just made it look really easy, birdieing the same par 5, got to 17. 18 is a wide open tee shot. The only thing you can't do is snap hook the ball in the water. She aimed way right, hit a nice little draw, hit the green, two putt, and that was that. And big win, I think, from the LPGA's perspective because Lydia Ko is now the best player in the world again. She is not number one in the Rolex Women's World Golf Ranking. That's probably a formality at this point. But you've got a battery of great players at the top of the game between Lydia Ko, Nelly Korda, Itali Tikal, and Jin-Young Ko, who's hurt with a bad wrist. We'll see how long that lingers, and hopefully an offseason is good for her and her game. But you've got four really, really great players at the top of the world right now. And then beyond that, you still have some really, really great talent going into a Solheim Cup year. But for Lydia Ko, a great story because in 2019 and 20, she just didn't seem to have it. I mean, she went to David Ledbetter, worked on her game with him. He taught her this A-frame swing, which I have the book here in my office. It is not effective for her. Let's put it that way. And she wound up going down a divergent path, trying to chase distance, trying to chase what she had, trying to find the right person, trying to find the right caddy, find the right things to kind of bring her back to where she was. She hooks up with Sean Foley. She finally gets back through into the winner's circle in 2021. And then she ramps up with what she calls her most consistent season this year. It is pretty remarkable what she has accomplished in really 15, 16 months, getting back from someone who really couldn't make a top 10 on the LPGA into someone who is the best player on the LPGA. She won the Player of the Year race, which is the Rolex Award. She won the Vair Trophy for the scoring average winner. She obviously won the season-ending tournament. She won in Korea, and then she won early in the season as well. And for her to get back to this level is a pretty amazing accomplishment. And she was emotional about it. I mean, I don't really recall any time seeing Lydia Ko cry on the golf course, happy or sad, but winning the golf tournament, it kind of all let it out. And she started crying and being embraced by her fellow players. Her players like her, her peers like her. She's a very likable person, and she's very thoughtful in the way that she talks about herself and golf. She answers thoughtful questions with thoughtful answers, and she's fun to be around. And I think that's really makes her a great ambassador for the tour, and she's someone that's really easy to like. So now she's going to be getting married in the offseason. She's 25. She has June, her fiancé. She finally mentioned his name. Didn't know that till the newser after she had won. And this was her last tournament as a single person. She's going to get married, and then I assume she will return in January, not taking some kind of extended break, have some kind of honeymoon, and then come back for the 2023 season and hopefully build upon what she has done here that leaves her 2 points away from qualifying for the LPGA's Hall of Fame, which I would argue is one of the most difficult to qualify for in all of sports because it's points-based. There is no voting. You don't get the points, you don't get in. You have to get 27 points, and that's through a combination of wins, major championships, season-ending awards like the Player of the Year and the Vair Trophy. If you get those all adding up over the course of a career, get 27 points, and then you put in whatever amount of 10 years of service, then you get into the Hall of Fame, which is exceedingly difficult to do. You can get the World Golf Hall of Fame on a vote, but you can't get in the LPGA Hall of Fame on a vote. And so that's something that's a big deal, I think, to Lydia Ko, although she downplayed it a little bit after the tournament, said it wasn't necessarily a motivating factor for the next season, but I think it will be once she gets, especially we have 1 point away, 1 win away from that figure. One thing I did want to point out about this week, and I have talked about this elsewhere, we started doing the 19th Hole Golf Show again, which is a once-a-week podcast, got a deep dive in issues in golf. This is not that. This is more analysis of the top stories of the day pretty quickly, but on the 19th hole, we went into this a little bit, and there are some rough feelings, hurt feelings at the end of the week, I think, for CME Group and Terry Duffy, because the LPGA kind of messed up this week, and Molly Marcos-Sammon, who is the commissioner of the LPGA, admitted as much in this report by Bethann Nichols of Golf Week, who's the preeminent reporter on the LPGA, along with Steve Eubanks. They do a great, great job. Eubanks does it for Global Golf Post and the LPGA, but they're out there more often than anybody else. They're the beat writers. And I guess ahead of the week, there was supposed to be a CME Group uses this tournament as kind of a VIP thing. A lot of companies do when they sponsor a tournament, bring a sales meeting, they have clients, they bring it all together. And they were supposed to have an outing on, or, you know, a dinner type thing on Tuesday. Serena Williams was supposed to come speak, and then anywhere from like 10 to 15 top players were supposed to show up and be recognized and be part of it. And so Serena Williams had to cancel for whatever reason, and that was unfortunate. But then all of the LPGA players that were planning on attending didn't show up either. And no one told Terry Duffy, who was standing at a podium, had the lights turned on to acknowledge the players that were there, and none of them were there. So he was personally embarrassed and very upset about that. Rightfully so. Makes sense. Whatever the reason was, whether it was some kind of communications failure, whether it was something on the LPGA's behalf, they needed to communicate better to the folks at CME Group because of the cancellation. Whatever the reason, you got a guy who's cutting huge checks upset with the LPGA, and he said specifically he is concerned about the future of the LPGA because of its leadership and because the players, he feels, maybe aren't as well aware or as well versed in the gospel, that there needs to be some kind of, you know, fluffing of the sponsors. I mean, that's how this works. That's how particularly at the LPGA, purses go up. That's how sponsors get involved. You find the right sponsors who want to support women's golf, who want to bring up purses closer to the level of the PGA Tour, and you work with them. You fulfill their needs. And the prior commissioner, Mike Wann, did a great job of that. But Mike Wann's now the head of the USGA, and so he may have taken some of that culture with him, not sure, but that creates a really awkward situation for someone like Terry Duffy, who went to Mike Wann and said he wanted to do this 4 years ago when he created this version of the CME Group Tour Championship. And now he has a different relationship with Molly Marcos-Sammet, who's 18 months into the job, and it doesn't seem like it's clicking in perhaps the same way. So I am very interested to see what happens from here. I don't think Terry Duffy's going to walk away. I don't think this is that level of a thing, but I also don't think this is a one-time incident. I think this is a ramping up of things that Duffy has perhaps noticed and concerns him. Now, have we heard that from other LPGA sponsors? No, that they haven't been vocal about that, but that doesn't mean that those issues don't exist. And if you look at the 2023 schedule, on one hand, you've got lots to like. The LPGA is playing for more than $100 million in purses for the first time ever. That's a huge accomplishment for the LPGA and what has built over the last, really, Wann's tenure of a decade and the last few years as well. However, half of that money comes from the five majors and this tournament, the season-ending CME Group Tour Championship. So six tournaments out of 33, basically, make up half the money. So you've got a couple of new tournaments coming in. You've got the Mizuho America's Classic, which is a very nice tournament, really good idea. It's going to be in Jersey City, $3 million purse. You've got the JM Eagle LA Championship, which takes over the LA Open kind of spot at Wilshire, and that's a $3 million event. You've got a couple of events in China coming back, probably, maybe. The Swinging Skirts in Taiwan as well. So you've got those three tournaments coming back. But you're also losing a couple of tournaments. You lost just a couple of different tournaments on the schedule. And you have to have some forethought into trying to bring in new sponsors while supporting the old sponsors who have been there forever and putting on tournaments of $1.5 million and $1.75 million purses, trying to bring them along, bring them up, bring in new sponsors because you want the minimum new purse to be $2 million and put it all together. There's a lot of work that goes into this. You can't just finger point right away, but it seems like there's some leadership challenge perhaps in trying to make all that work. Of course, that's the job, but also among the players to kind of figure out, yes, they're getting great money at the top end of the major championship level from these sponsors that have gotten involved. But at the same time, you've got to be able to work with the classic sponsors and kind of grease the wheels and make it all work for a tour for everybody that has the right number of events. 30 to 33 events is right about right for the LPGA Tour. And so they've got to figure out how to make this jibe with the sponsorship moving forward. All right, second story is something from last week, actually. We just never got to it. And it's something kind of worth digging into with, 10 minutes worth of time that we have left in the show. And that is Patrick Reed's ridiculous $750 million lawsuit that was filed originally in Texas that moved to Jacksonville in a federal court. That lawsuit has been dismissed by the judge presiding over the case. Now, you may have heard that headline that the case has been dismissed, and that is correct. U.S. District Judge Timothy Corrigan did just that. He dismissed the case, and that was the original case that was filed as a defamation lawsuit against a variety of parties, but the parties were Golf Week and his parent company, Gannett, Eamon Lynch, Brandel Chamblee, Golf Channel, Damon Hack, and Shane Bacon. They were all named in the original lawsuit for $750 million. And basically just with this notion that Larry Klayman, who is this guy who loves to file frivolous lawsuits, and really I probably never won a significant case in his life, but if you look at what he's filed here, he filed a lawsuit that was originally written by like a seventh grader with very poor grammar and very poor understanding of what was at play here. And the judge then took the refiled suit in Florida, Judge Corrigan, and looked at it and said, look, Reed has made more than 120 different accusations in his filing, but he assigns all of the parties involved to all of the accusations. That's not fair. You can't do that. And so this is an improperly filed case. So he dismissed that out of hand and said, this can't work, but you have until December 16th to refile this case with us, refile this complaint with us, doing so correctly. So to read from Corrigan's order, he says, Reed's complaint does not cleanly fit into one of the four types of shotgun pleadings, which means get something done really quick. However, it fails to give defendants notice of the grounds upon which each claim rests, because Reed alleges 120 factual allegations, then proceeds to incorporate all 120 allegations into each and every count. Reed attempts to allege various defamation and civil conspiracy violations against each defendant, causes of action which require vastly different factual allegations. So basically what he's saying is, you're assigning every allegation to every defendant, which is not possible, and also you have to bring a different set of facts to this to try to kind of make sense of what you're alleging in the first place. So again, we kind of made fun of this on Twitter at the time. Very poorly written, very poorly understood lawsuit. However, he does not have the out-of-hand rejection of the court. He does have until December 16th with Larry Klayman, which is what? 3 weeks away, 4 weeks away to get it all together and then try to re-sue all of these people and see where that goes, which probably very well will be dismissed out of hand again. Like Klayman said in a press release about all this, that he wanted to make it clear that, yes, this complaint was dismissed, but not the whole thing was dismissed. And that is factually accurate, and it's important to point out, the case is not done and dusted, just that complaint is written is absolutely gone. Now, there are other cases that Klayman has brought, either on Reed's behalf or as a class action lawsuit. So Reed still has another $250 million lawsuit filed against Shane Ryan, Hachette, a publisher, the New York Post, Fox Sports, the Associated Press, and Doug Ferguson, who is the Associated Press beat writer. Similar set of complaints around defamation, and I'm almost certain that will also be dismissed out of hand, because it just will be. And then there's another civil action that Klayman brought as a class action lawsuit against the PGA Tour and the DP World Tour and the official World Golf Ranking, because it alleges anti-competitive practices and a bunch of other stuff. And that was filed in Palm Beach County's 15th Judicial Circuit on Monday. That's not in a federal court. And that's a different case altogether. We'll see where that leads. It's not that Larry Klayman's going away. It's just that his lawsuits are starting to dry up one by one. And we kind of knew this going into it. And this is just going to land Reed worse positioning. And I think Reed does this to himself a lot. And on one hand, that kind of makes me feel sad for the guy, because he's being advised in the wrong way by the wrong people to do certain things. And I'm not convinced that this is always his gut instinct. And of course, I'm someone who wants to think the best of people. I have screwed up on takes on Twitter multiple times this year, talking about when I fell for Bryson DeChambeau saying he kind of reassessed his relationship with God. And really, that was just an excuse or a papier-mâché to sign with Liv for nine figures. And then when Cam Smith, I won the Open, and the rumors were swirling around him, but I said, hey, this is what it's all about, winning the Open Championship, winning the Claire Jug, and then, of course, he signs with Liv. I still don't think that was a mess-up. I mean, that was just what I feel about the Open Championship. But still, you have a tendency to kind of want to believe the best in people, and you want to take them at face value, even though I'm a very skeptical person. I'm cynical of people's motivation. However, in this case, Reed has always acted this way. I don't think it's necessarily just petulance on his part. I think he is being supported by people who are leading him astray, who are leading him down the wrong path. There is no way Patrick Reed believed in good conscience that he was going to win $1 billion in two lawsuits against all of the folks that he sued. First of all, they don't have the money. Second of all, that was never going to work. And I think the second that he read what was filed, or maybe he never read it at all, he was probably getting roasted left, right, and center from his Liv colleagues. He has sued Fox Sports, the one and only company in American media with a broadcast network that could air Liv Golf. And he has sued them. That doesn't make any sense. And so I'm wondering where he gets this counsel from. How did all of this come about? How did someone contact Patrick Reed through Larry Klayman and say, you know what, buddy? You are owed $1 billion because of defamation. We're going to do it. And we're going to get that money on your behalf. Did Reed believe that? Did that Did he come to that conclusion that, yes, this is it. We've done it. We're going to stick it to the media and get paid back many times over for the money that we believe we've lost? That doesn't make sense. So I just don't understand where this is coming from, where the advice is coming from, or where it goes from here. Because if it all gets dismissed, and that is absolutely plausible on the personal front, he could refile on the 16th and just get dismissed out of hand again. And that would be the end of it, at least on that suit. And something similar can happen on the $250 million suit against Shane Ryan et al. So then what? Do you just find another person to sue? Do you just walk away? What is the state of play for Patrick Reed? And one thing I found out about in all of this is interesting. He owns the franchise rights to distribution of Grindworks in this country. So that's why he wears the Grindworks logo on his hat. It's not because that they sponsor him. It's because he owns it. It's because it's his. It's his logo to use. So he has backed himself into a corner with the relationships he has created and the way he has worked with people. And I think if he just approached things differently over the years, all of this could have been avoided. The cheating aside, the very blasé use of the rules, laissez-faire use of the rules aside. But I think he could have been better liked if he had just done things differently. And I really wonder sometimes where it went wrong for the guy. He's accomplished a Masters win. That's a big deal in golf. He's won some big tournaments. He's a very gifted golfer. But then everything else just leaves you dumbfounded. And I don't know the answer to that. And I'm probably never going to know the answer to that. But especially because I'm blocked on Twitter by the guy. But I just don't get it. And I wonder how people go down paths like this. So I'll just leave it at that. Leave you to decide. And hopefully you come up with the answer, because I sure as hell am not. That's going to do it for us today on Two at the First. Thank you so much for the company of your time. I appreciate it. If you listen to us through a podcast service, please give us a 5-star review. It helps us reach more people. Thank you for telling people about us. We've had a really great response these last few months since doing the show. Again, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday show this week. No Thursday. Maybe Friday. We'll see, depending on what happens in the world. But thank you so much for checking us out once again. And we will talk to you tomorrow on Two at the First.